Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video from a channel called Premier Unbelievable, which asks the question, can you prove Jesus' resurrection? Given the evidence that I've seen thus far, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that the answer is no. But maybe these guys have something new. So let's go!
As we approach Easter, one of the things I've been thinking about is whether we can prove that Jesus really rose from the dead. And I suppose it kind of depends what you mean by prove, because proof in its truest sense only really exists in the realm of math.
Yeah, strictly speaking, proof is mainly a mathematical concept. That said, colloquially speaking, when someone asks you for proof of something, they're probably wanting you to demonstrate that thing in such a way as to be convincing to them.
Well, we all know that Rod is always bite. He had the chance to bite me before and he didn't.
Prove it.
See?
Now, what will convince someone is different from person to person. To prove that God exists, some people are content to observe beauty in nature. Others are happy to have had a personal experience, and many would prefer there to be actual tangible evidence that points to a god, and everyone is slightly different. So what really interests me here with regards to this hypothetical question that you could have phrased any way you like is that instead of opting to phrase it in a way that's more clear, for instance, you could have said, can you demonstrate the truth of Jesus' resurrection, or does the evidence point to the resurrection being a true event? But rather than do that, you phrased it as prove Jesus' resurrection, apparently specifically so that you could engage in this hedging maneuver that you're doing. So when it turns out that there really isn't great evidence for the event, that's okay, because 100% proof is only in math. Well, how about you stop playing word games and just tell me what you got?
So I can obviously 100% prove to you that 1 + 1 = 2. But even scientists need to employ a certain amount of faith. So when they do science, they need to believe that there is a certain order to the world, that when they do things, they'll react in a certain way because forces like gravity are in play.
Posing it as a matter of faith is a bit disingenuous, is it not? Now, this appears to be the sort of equivocation with the word faith that apologists often engage in. When a scientist uses faith to assume that the laws of physics will remain stable from day to day, it's trust based on previous experience. The laws of physics don't appear to have changed since the universe began, so we have 13.7 billion years of precedent to rely on to say that they will probably continue to not change tomorrow. Apologists will then equate this with faith in God, which is the belief without evidence definition of faith. The thing is, if there were actually sufficient evidence to warrant a belief in the resurrection, you wouldn't need to start with all this hedging based on word games. So the fact that you need to start by saying, well, technically proof only exists in math, and scientists have to have faith that the universe will operate in the same way tomorrow as it did today, in my mind counts as evidence against your position.
In a similar way, we also can't prove lots of things that we rely on a daily basis. So you can't 100% prove that your mum loves you. There might be lots of evidence for it, but you can't 100% prove it.
Again, though, and here I'm speaking for myself, as I'm sure there are many people watching who have less than ideal relationships with their mothers for whom this example doesn't really work. But if you can provide me the same level of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus as my mother provides me for the fact that she loves me, then that would definitely be sufficient. But something tells me you won't even be able to manage something as basic as my mother telling me herself that she loves me. The equivalent here being Jesus actually showing up and telling me himself that he did come back from the dead. He did it for Thomas after all, but everyone else in history is supposed to just take it on faith.
But I think what we can do with the area of science and with these things that we sort of rely on every day is we have proof in the sense of a law court. So I don't know whether you've heard that phrase that lawyers use quite a lot, proof beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes, we've all heard that phrase. And if you properly understood what it meant in the legal sense, you probably wouldn't want to apply that standard to the evidence for the resurrection. Basically, a reasonable doubt is a doubt that arises from reason, logic, or common sense, and it is the highest legal bar to clear than any other standard. So, for instance, for a police officer to arrest someone, they need only have reasonable grounds to believe that the person committed a crime. So, for instance, if a store is robbed and two or three witnesses tell police that it was one particular person that did it, it is not outside the realm of possibility that they were all mistaken. Like, the guy who actually robbed the store just kind of looks like the guy that they all pointed to. So, while these witness testimonies are likely enough for an arrest, a conviction would need more than that. Security footage of the robbery, for instance. If there is no security footage, and no evidence is found apart from the witness testimonies, then we have reasonable doubt that this person committed the crime, even if it is more likely that the witnesses were correct than not. Because it is not outside the realm of possibility that they were mistaken. The best way to establish reasonable doubt is to use the facts in evidence to construct an alternate narrative that has the accused not committing the crime. In the case of Jesus being accused of coming back from the dead, given that the only evidence we have is from documents that weren't written until well after the event and show signs of colluding with each other while simultaneously being plagued with irreconcilable contradictions, there are many possible narratives for how these documents could have wound up talking about Jesus as though he did come back from the dead that do not involve an actual resurrection. And by the reasonable doubt standard, this leaves us with enough room to doubt that we cannot convict Jesus of being guilty of resurrecting. Now, the reasonable alternatives are many, but personally I'm partial to the one put forth by Paulogia, where the whole story of Christianity could have had its origin in nothing more than a single bereavement hallucination, followed by word-of-mouth storytelling combined with embellishment, eventually leading to Paul having his experience, which Paulogia attributes to possibly a psychotic break caused by guilt associated with having persecuted Christians, but could have been any number of things, including his having just made up his personal experience in order to enjoy the benefits that come along with being a religious leader. I don't personally think the Paul was lying option is the most likely possible explanation, but the fact remains that it is a possible explanation, and there are also several other naturalistic explanations that are even more plausible than that one. So using the beyond a reasonable doubt standard would leave us not believing in the resurrection for sure.
Again, they can't mathematically 100% prove that someone has or hasn't done the crime, but what they can do is build up a case based on eyewitness testimony, confession, and other types of evidence.
Well, eyewitness testimony is actually one of the least reliable forms of evidence that there is. In fact, in roughly half of all cases of wrongful conviction, mistaken eyewitness testimony was the primary reason for conviction. There are issues with confessions as well, but I don't think that's really relevant here. A confession, for the purposes of a criminal trial, is when the defendant has themselves made a voluntary statement of admission. Jesus may have confessed to people in the gospel stories that he came back from the dead, but I doubt such documents would be admissible in court. They are anonymously authored, show signs of modifying the story to serve a particular purpose rather than being worried about recounting events accurately, they weren't written until at least 30 years after the events that they allegedly record, and they show all the signs that cold case detective J. Warner Wallace warns us are indications that they were colluding to get their story straight rather than just giving an accurate report of events from their perspectives. Except, of course, where the stories diverge in contradictory ways for what usually appear to be theologically motivated reasons.
And I think that's the sort of proof that we're talking about when we're looking at whether Jesus rose from the dead.
So the kind of proof that you're talking about is the kind that is known to be the least reliable, and in the best case scenario is hearsay of hearsay, with the original source for the hearsay being a subject of speculation that ultimately remains unknown. The best that could be offered comes from Paul, who is the only person we know of who actually claims to have seen the risen Christ for themselves. In all other instances, it's a matter of other people claiming that those people saw a risen Christ. And in Paul's case, it's described in a way that makes it pretty clear that it was not a physical apparition, but a spiritual one. He directly says in Galatians 1 that the gospel message that he is preaching did not come from a man, but from revelation. His conversion story, as described in Acts, also makes it rather clear that it was a spiritual rather than physical experience. He saw a light and heard a voice. No mention of meeting an actual person, and depending on whether we're reading Acts chapter 9 or chapter 22, the people that were with him either saw the light and heard nothing, or heard a voice but didn't see anything. Either way, even if we allow for the harmonization where the Greek word for hear in one of those contexts would be better translated as understand, so that the one that says they heard nothing should actually be that they did hear it, they just didn't understand it, we're still left with an experience where a disembodied light spoke to Paul. The only time Paul speaks in a way that might lead us to believe that he was talking about a physical resurrection is when he wrote down the Creed in 1 Corinthians 15, and added himself to the list of people to whom a risen Jesus had appeared. But there are a couple problems here. First, it never explicitly states that he was raised bodily from the dead. I will concede that that is definitely implied, but that's where we get to the next issue. These are not Paul's words. Apologists will often use the fact that this is a creed that predates Paul's writings to try and get the claim of a resurrected Jesus as close to the time of the crucifixion as possible. But then this leaves us with the problem that the only eyewitness account in the Bible of a resurrection that is written in a way that may indicate a bodily resurrection is not actually an eyewitness account, but just a traditional recitation to which Paul added his own name. We don't get any unequivocal accounts of a bodily resurrected Jesus until the anonymously authored gospel accounts, which have massive issues of their own.
But if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then we need to find another alternative to explain the empty tomb, the fact that no one's ever found his body.
I mean, the alternative is there really are no reliable accounts that even have Jesus placed in a tomb in the first place. Paul certainly doesn't say that, he just says he was buried. That could mean any kind of burial, including what typically happened to crucifixion victims, an unmarked mass grave. The empty tomb narrative doesn't show up until the Gospels, and there are so many issues with the empty tomb accounts in the Gospels that Gary Habermas, the guy who literally wrote the book on the minimal facts argument, no longer lists the empty tomb as one of the facts that is not in dispute among historians. So since that isn't a well-established fact, we don't really even need to come up with an explanation for it. Now, that said, it's actually not that hard to come up with an alternative naturalistic explanation. The disciples stealing the body is not entirely implausible. It doesn't have to be all of them, just one or two. Maybe they didn't like that their Lord was being buried in a tomb that belonged to one of the members of the council that condemned him to death, and so they wanted to give him what they thought would be a more respectful burial. Then when the empty tomb was found, and people started claiming that Jesus was back from the dead, they were either too scared to come forward, or for one reason or another, decided to encourage that belief. As to the guard at the tomb, that was only mentioned in one gospel, and the way that it's referenced makes it clear that this is the author of Matthew giving a post hoc apologetic response to this very accusation. He comes right out and says that the disciple stealing the body while the guards were asleep is a story that is spread among the Jews to this day. But in order to believe Matthew's apologetic for that story, we have to either believe that the guard was not a Roman guard, and Pilate chose a really weird way to tell the chief priests to use their own soldiers. When asked, Pilate responds by saying, "You have a guard of soldiers, go make it as secure as you can." A plain reading would suggest that Pilate is giving them a Roman guard, but an argument can be made that "you have a guard of soldiers" is him essentially saying, "You got your own guys, why are you asking me for mine?" So even if we believe the guard at the tomb story, either it wasn't the well-trained and disciplined Roman guard who would be executed for falling asleep at their posts, instead being a group of temple guards who may well have actually fallen asleep, or else you must believe that a Roman guard went to the Jewish chief priests when something went wrong, and then agreed to spread a story that would get them executed in order to pretend that Jesus' body was stolen, something that they, as Romans, probably didn't care all that much about. Alternatively, since this is the only account that includes any kind of guard, we could just dismiss it for what it is, a post hoc apologetic rationalization meant to explain away the possibility that Jesus' body was stolen. So even if we accept the Gospels as being somewhat reliable, the naturalistic explanation still ends up looking more plausible than an actual resurrection.
And here are a few alternatives. Well, maybe Jesus didn't die. Maybe he got into the tomb and the coolness of the tomb kind of revived him and he walked out of the tomb.
Yeah, I'm not really a fan of swoon theory. Now, sure, there is an account recorded in the autobiography of Josephus where three people survived crucifixion, but they were let down early and nursed back to health, and even then, two out of three of them may have still been alive on their crosses, but they died after being taken down. So the idea that a barely alive Jesus managed to recover from crucifixion inside a cold, dank tomb is not really a plausible one in my opinion. Although, I did recently just stumble across a variation on swoon theory, which is still implausible, but it makes a lot more sense than the typical one. The idea is that Jesus was barely alive when they brought him down from the cross, and his followers who retrieved his body noticed that and are now scared because they have illegally taken down a condemned criminal. So they put on a decoy burial and attempted to nurse Jesus back to health in secret, but he dies anyway, so they bury him secretly in an unmarked grave. But there's a rumor going around that he did survive on the cross, so in an attempt to quell the rumors before something comes of them, the Romans open the tomb and find only the burial linens that were used in the decoy burial, with no body. This is still not a very plausible scenario, but it beats the classic swoon theory in my opinion, and as unlikely as it is, it's still far more likely than an actual resurrection.
So perhaps Jesus' body was stolen. I mean, maybe it was stolen by the disciples.
Again, not my favorite explanation, but certainly plausible. Unless you believe the guard at the tomb story, which in my opinion is even more implausible than the disciple stealing the body.
But the problem we have here is the people that were put in charge of guarding tombs, of guarding dead bodies so that people didn't steal the bodies, were Roman soldiers, and apparently these guys were even more hardcore than Marines.
Since we have already dealt with this claim, I will be skipping the rest of it. But because apologists so often hype up how highly trained and disciplined the Roman soldiers were in order to make it seem like an impossible task for a bunch of fishermen to sneak past them to steal a body, this then leaves us with the aforementioned problem of such well-trained and disciplined individuals deciding to report first to the Jewish priests instead of the Roman higher-ups, and then to spread a rumor that, were it to reach their bosses, would result in them being executed in exchange for a bribe. Honestly, a bunch of fishermen successfully sneaking past highly trained Roman soldiers does seem more plausible than that.
I think something that's even more significant that we've got to think about is the fact that most of these disciples went on to be killed for their faith. Would they have died for something that they knew was a lie? I know I wouldn't.
Well, setting aside the fact that the majority of the disciples drop out of reliable history pretty much immediately, and that we never actually learn how any of them died until church tradition started speculating centuries after the fact, people do die for lies, at least sometimes. What's more, even if we do believe the church tradition accounts, which are so reliable when it comes to historical details that you won't find any Christians anywhere relying on them for anything other than just the martyrdom of the disciples, but even if we do accept these martyrdom accounts, none of them tell us that the disciples had any chance to save themselves by recanting their stories, which is a pretty crucial part of the argument. After all, can it really be said to be dying for a lie if you didn't know that you were going to die for it when you told it, and when you're caught, you're just killed without ever being given the opportunity to change your story? I mean, Joseph Smith never recanted his story, and he was killed for it. Does that mean that Mormonism is true? If it was a calmer situation and he just had someone pointing a gun at his head and was asked to recant his story or else he'd get shot, would he have recanted? The truth of the matter is that we do not know and can only guess. Well, the same applies to the disciples. But that's also granting the martyrdom accounts, which I see no reason to do, given that the people that want us to believe those particular accounts are not equally eager to believe the other details from those same stories. It just stinks of confirmation bias. I like that bit of information, so I'll believe that one and just put everything else over to the side.
So maybe it wasn't the disciples that stole the body. Maybe it was the Roman or the Jewish authorities.
Well, probably not the Jewish ones, but given the accounts of the behavior of Pontius Pilate that come from outside the Bible, I could see that being the type of practical joke he might want to play. He often went out of his ways to just piss off the Jewish community, to the point where Tiberius Caesar actually removed him from office because he just wouldn't stop. I doubt he would care if another minor religion formed around the guy whose body he was stealing, even if it would potentially result in violence. He rather seemed to enjoy provoking the residents of Judea to violence. So, again, not necessarily a very likely scenario, but one that is a lot more plausible than an actual resurrection. Come to think of it, that actually makes the Roman guard story from Matthew make a lot more sense. Pilate gives the chief priests a guard at the tomb and secretly orders them to get rid of the body when nobody's looking, and then the guards are opportunists who use this as a chance to squeeze a bit of money out of the chief priests by getting them to bribe them into lying about having fallen asleep, safe in the knowledge that they won't be punished for it because they were carrying out their orders from Pilate. Again, I don't think this explanation is even necessary in the first place, and it is unlikely, but it does fit the data better than an actual resurrection.
But I think the problem you've got with this is they were trying to disprove that Jesus had risen from the dead. They were adamant that he hadn't risen from the dead. And if they had his dead body, why would they not have wheeled it out to prove that he hadn't risen from the dead?
Well, I would maintain that they wouldn't really have cared all that much if some people thought that he had risen, but if Pilate had stolen the body, it is entirely possible that he would have moved it into one of the other crucifixion burial sites, and so wouldn't necessarily have known which body it was at that point. If you're stealing a dude's body as a practical joke, and the joke is against people that you regularly treat with scorn and derision, are you really going to be careful enough with the body to be able to find it later, or would it have been more of a just get rid of it, I don't need to know the details sort of thing?
So perhaps it wasn't the disciples that stole the body, or the authorities that stole the body. Maybe it was tomb robbers.
Unlikely. Tomb robbers would generally go for the valuables that are placed in tombs with the bodies, rather than the bodies themselves.
And this, on first glance, might be the most realistic option.
Quite the contrary. On first glance, it's the one I find easiest to dismiss. Well, aside from the actual resurrection, that is.
But then you look a bit further into it, and you see that what's left in the tomb is the expensive spices and the grave clothes that would have been used to embalm the body to stop it stinking when it had been rotting away for a few days.
Okay, this doesn't matter at all, but correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the empty tomb discovered when the women were headed to the tomb in order to apply the spices? Would the spices have been left in the tomb, or would they have just brought them with them? I mean, Mark 16:1 literally has the women who go to the tomb buying the spices on their way there, and Luke 24:1 says that they were bringing the spices that they had prepared. So why would we think that there were already expensive spices in the tomb?
So perhaps the people that claim to have seen the risen Jesus, maybe they were hallucinating.
This is the one that I like the best. Because the fact of the matter is that we only have one eyewitness account to the resurrection from Paul. And he describes it in a way that is consistent with hallucination. Now, of course, Christianity does appear to have existed before Paul, so we need to figure out how the resurrection story began in the first place, but at the end of the day, we do not know for sure. We have no reliable information from that time. But if we assume that the Gospels are at least somewhat reliable, we know that Jesus had a group of traveling companions who loved him very much. And do you know what happens to a decent percentage of people when they lose someone whom they loved very much? Bereavement hallucinations. They happen fairly frequently in people that have no history of mental disorders, and depending on the cultural context in which they are experienced, they could be interpreted as messages from the deceased, often providing comfort. In fact, this is an area that I have some personal experience with. I have had bereavement hallucinations, and even knowing what I already knew about them, it was hard not to believe that my wife was alive. On more than one occasion, I found myself searching through all the various documents that I had to send out to banks and whatnot, wondering how I would ever manage to convince them that she wasn't dead after I had followed the procedure so carefully to tell them that she was. I know this is just one anecdotal data point, and so doesn't mean much scientifically, but I can absolutely see how such an experience could lead someone to actually come to believe that their loved one really did come back from the dead, especially in a culture that didn't have an understanding of this phenomenon as a hallucinatory experience. The actual rate of hallucination depends on the closeness of the relationships, but for spouses, it typically hits between 30 and 60% of people. So if we assume that the disciples love Jesus as much as someone loves a spouse, which I'm sure the church would agree with, then that means there were probably between 3 and 7 disciples who would have had these very powerful experiences, assuming that this all had to start with one of the 12, and not including Judas in that calculation for what I would think are obvious reasons. So if you start with a handful of disciples telling the Jesus story in their communities, including some details about him being still alive and them having experiences with the still living Jesus, as people spread the story, it grows, as stories do. By the time it gets to Paul, it's a burgeoning religion. Paul either has a psychotic break brought about by feelings of guilt for having persecuted these people and has a hallucination of his own, or else he saw an opportunity to be a founding member of a new religion, along with all the benefits of having other people pay your expenses, and boom, Christianity is born.
Again, there's a problem with this, and that is that psychologists will talk about the fact that people who have hallucinations are often people with vivid imaginations. And actually, a lot of the disciples don't fit this description.
Well, I'm not sure if that applies to bereavement hallucinations, but personally, I actually don't have all that vivid of an imagination. So even if they do tend to happen more in people with vivid imaginations, it's not outside the realm of possibility that it would still happen to someone without vivid imaginations. So even if we accept your claim that none of the disciples had vivid imaginations, it's still entirely possible, likely even, that they had bereavement hallucinations.
just as a small example, you've got Matthew, who was a shrewd tax collector. You've got Peter, who was a tough fisherman. And then you've got Thomas, who's pretty much a born skeptic, born to not believe this stuff.
Okay, I thought for sure you were going to be bringing up the stories where the disciples are clearly a bunch of idiots who were incapable of understanding even the most basic of parables without Jesus shoving their meanings down their throats. But I guess tax collectors, fishermen, and skeptics are all just people who don't have vivid imaginations in your mind. Seems like a bit of a stretch, to be honest. Maybe stick with the "they were clearly a bunch of idiots because the gospel authors needed an excuse to spell it out for their intended audience" version, where you leave the "they were essentially a plot device" part out of it.
The other thing with hallucinations is there's no such thing as a collective hallucination. You don't have a group of people all hallucinating the same thing. They might have different hallucinations, but not all hallucinating the same thing.
Sure, I can get behind that. I know you're likely about to bring up the 500 witnesses part of the creed in 1 Corinthians, so tell me, where does it describe in detail what the people saw at that event? Assuming it was a real event, all we know is that Jesus appeared. For all we know, he appeared in different ways to each person at that event and in spiritual form, not bodily form. Also, I wonder if you're a Catholic, because they have a miracle that is way more reliably documented than the 500 witnesses thing, and most Protestants don't think it was real. The miracle of the sun. Thousands of people gathered together and saw a heavenly apparition of the Virgin Mary, represented by the sun doing a bunch of crazy shit, with many claiming that the wet mud that they had been standing on instantly dried in the 10 or so minutes of Mary's appearance. There even exist video interviews with the people that actually experienced it that you can watch to this day.
And then the sun started to roll, like dancing from one place to another place.
That's much better than Paul's, "Yeah, 500 people saw Jesus, and you can go check with them if you want, but I don't know any of their names, so have fun with that." The miracle of the sun's documentation is far superior to that of Paul's 500 anonymous witnesses, and yet Protestants will dismiss the miracle of the sun and then turn right around and claim that Paul's 500 witnesses had to have actually seen a risen Jesus because group hallucinations just don't happen.
And we hear stories of groups of people believing that they saw the risen Jesus. And in 1 Corinthians 15, you see a group of 500 people claiming to have seen the risen Jesus.
Yeah, there it is. Interesting that she pluralized that, saying that we have multiple stories of groups of people, followed by bringing up the one single story that exists with multiple witnesses to the same event. If there were multiple accounts of multiple events that had multiple witnesses, you'd think we'd hear about more than just the 500 people one.
That couldn't have been a hallucination. The final thing about hallucinations is they tend to be of expected events. You know, we hallucinate something that we kind of anticipate happening. And actually the Jewish concept of resurrection, of people rising from the dead, was so unlike what happened to Jesus that it wouldn't have been an anticipated event. The disciples would have been just as surprised about Jesus rising from the dead as we are.
Huh. Well, credit where it's due. I haven't heard that one before. I feel like it's not an accurate statement, though, based on the fact that Jesus' resurrection was pretty similar to other resurrections in the Bible. He died, was laid to rest, and then got up and started to walk around again. That's what happened to both kids that Elijah and Elisha raised from the dead. Actually, if we believe the gospel accounts, then even if you want to quibble about the differences between the other resurrection stories and Jesus, you know, since they're not identical, they are just very similar, Jesus pretty much raised Lazarus from the dead in a manner that was identical to his own resurrection. Dude had been dead several days, he'd been wrapped in linen and placed in a tomb with a stone covering the entrance, stone gets rolled away, and out he comes. So to say that Jesus' resurrection was in a manner that they would never have imagined on their own ultimately doesn't matter. They didn't have to imagine it, they just had to remember that time when Jesus did it before. But at the end of the day, I'm not actually convinced that the original hallucination that kicked the whole thing off would have been experienced at the same level of detail as the later resurrection accounts found in the gospel, and the fact of the matter is that we have no details about what kind of resurrection may or may not have been hallucinated by the 500, so it's a bit of a red herring to point out that Jewish beliefs about resurrection at the time were different than the story that eventually developed into Jesus' resurrection story.
So maybe they weren't hallucinating, but maybe those people who claim to have seen the risen Jesus, maybe they were lying.
Or maybe they didn't exist in the first place, and the story of them having seen Jesus was a result of storytelling and exaggeration as the story was passed from person to person in the early days. This kind of exaggeration is common and could easily turn 3 to 6 disciple hallucinations into a group of 500 that are in addition to the original 3 to 6.
I don't know about you, but I've seen a lot of kind of fake news stories about celebrities recently. And what you see is that their celebrity doing everything they can to then inform the public that actually it's not true. They're on social media kind of demeaning the story and saying it's not true. They're putting out their own story saying this is actually what happened. And I think exactly the same would have happened back then if Paul, who's sort of writing in the New Testament, if he had written a false account or if people were saying things that weren't true, then actually people who were there at the time would have jumped in to say that's not true.
Yeah, I don't think so. That's a fairly easy thing to do today because we have communication that travels slightly faster than horses and boats. But Paul didn't even name the 500 witnesses. So even if someone did come out and say that that's not what happened, Paul didn't give enough details to say for sure that the event that the person is claiming was being misrepresented was actually the event that Paul was writing about. I can tell you that 500 people from Niagara Falls saw a resurrected Elvis, and if I don't name the people, would any citizens of Niagara Falls just come forth and say that for sure that didn't happen? No, they'd probably just ignore it. And would you be able to fact check me? I mean, obviously in this day and age, if 500 people saw something extraordinary like that, someone would have gotten it on video. But setting that aside, since that wouldn't have been an option in Paul's time, how would you go about fact-checking that information? Now, think about the historical context of Paul's letter to the Corinthians. He's writing to a church in Corinth in Greece about an event that happened in or near Jerusalem, which is at least a 1,300-kilometer boat ride or a 3,000-kilometer journey by land. That's a hell of an inconvenient trip today, even with the availability of motorized transportation and the abundance of paved roads. Are we to believe that people who lived in Corinth back in the first century would have been both able and willing to take what would likely end up being several months out of their lives to travel to Jerusalem just in the hope of being able to talk to one of 500 people who aren't even named? Absolutely not.
And what I think, again, is really significant in 1 Corinthians 15, which is a letter that Paul has written, he name checks individuals who claim to have seen the risen Jesus.
The only people he actually names there are Peter, or Cephas, and James. He does mention the rest of the 12, so we can assume from that he probably meant the 12 disciples, and I imagine that this is after they've replaced Judas. So he doesn't name check very many people, and the people he does would mostly be made up of people who got the story started in the first place, so I doubt they would have had an issue with just being included on a list of people who have seen Jesus, with no other details about the experience being provided.
And he even says most of them are still around. As if to say, go and ask them. If you don't believe me, go and ask them what happened. And I think the fact that he's name-checking them says, look, go and look at the sources yourself and see if you think it's true.
That's a deceptive way to present that. You're making it sound like he named some of the 500 witnesses. He did not. Paul's report of the 500 witnesses amounts to Paul telling us that someone told him that 500 people saw Jesus that one time. That's as good as it gets. And actually, it's slightly worse than that, given that we don't have the original documents. So it's more like an anonymous scribe telling us that Paul told him that someone told him that there were 500 witnesses. But I don't think there's any evidence that the scribes who copied out that part of 1 Corinthians were meddling with it, so I am comfortable leaving the scribes out of it for now.
So they're kind of the other alternatives, and I think when we're thinking about this stuff, we've got to think, what is the best way to explain the hundreds of people who claim to have seen the risen Jesus? What is the best way to explain the fact that the disciples went from being pretty terrified and a bit useless to being fearless and going on to give their lives for this cause? And what is the best way to explain this incredible sudden growth of the early church?
Well, the 500 witnesses could easily be nothing more than an exaggeration meant to give a story more credibility. The disciples transforming from cowards into brave martyrs doesn't really need explaining, since the only accounts we have of them actually being brave martyrs are not considered reliable for any other details that they provide, and the early church doesn't appear to have actually grown any faster than any new sect or religion would have, at least not until it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and so was backed by the world's most powerful military force at the time. Seems fairly self-explanatory how it could have grown quickly from there.
And I think actually the best way to explain that, with no other convincing alternative, I don't think, is the resurrection, the fact that Jesus rose from the dead.
And that's where you really lose me, because at the end of the day, we don't need to provide alternate explanations for any of these events. An ancient book was wrong about something is all that's needed. Now, yes, it was several books. You can't just lump the New Testament into one book for the purpose of the study of history. But the fact that they are each wrong about this thing in ways that disagree with each other doesn't exactly help your case. Also, I find it interesting that I have to add the caveat about all the books in the Bible being different books written by different people, because when it suits their purposes, apologists will use this as a way to expand their list of sources for the life of Jesus, ignoring the blatant plagiarism that runs rampant throughout the Gospels. But at other times, they will point out that the Bible is one big cohesive narrative as a way of supporting the claim that it was inspired by God. So it's one book when they need it to be, and several books when they need it to be, and which way we're looking at it changes depending on what argument is being made.
And that may sound completely far-fetched, but actually it's a little bit like what Sherlock Holmes says. When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
This might be a bit of a hot take on my part, but Sherlock Holmes was a genius as written by an idiot. Now, don't get me wrong, Arthur Conan Doyle wasn't an idiot in every aspect of his life, but not even he liked his Sherlock Holmes stories, considering them to be too lowbrow. But my question here is, how can you possibly know every possibility or impossibility? How have you ruled out that there isn't an option that you just haven't thought of yet? I don't have enough arrogance to assume that I am ever going to figure out every possible way that the Jesus story could have come about, so how would I ever get to a point where I could say with certainty that I have eliminated every option and determined that they are all impossible except the one that involves an event that has never, not even once, been reliably documented in all of human history, that being the resurrection? That statement, the if you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth, is, at its base, an argument from ignorance. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Kirk Pryor, who says, "My girl jumped me while watching this. Didn't turn it off and put her in a position that I could still watch the video. Do what you will with this information." Well, Kirk, what I will is to make that my comment of the day, because I think that's just fantastic. I will die a happy man knowing that at least one person had sex while watching one of my videos. I just hope you paid her the attention she deserves for being willing to tolerate getting down and dirty while listening to me rambling about cosmology or whatever. And if you, dear listener, have had sex while watching one of my videos, sound off in the comments. If you haven't, tell me why not in the comments. Let's just completely destroy the comment section on this one. This is going to be somebody's first video. Someone out there has never heard of me before, clicked on this video, scrolled down to the comments before watching it, and is now wondering why the f*** everyone is talking about having sex while my videos are playing. Or more likely wondering why everyone is explaining why they would never have sex while my videos are playing. Let's just make it super weird and uncomfortable for them, because that's fun, I guess, for me. Thanks for watching, thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, who are the sweet, sweet love that is made to the sultry sound of my channel. If you'd like to f*** while I make jokes, talk about weird animal mating habits, and just generally be a weird person on YouTube in the background, well, you can just do that. I can't stop you, and I won't kink shame you for it. But also donate as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, because I had sex at least 3 times in the past and the resulting creatures are expensive as hell. It's all, I want to take saxophone lessons, and why haven't you signed us up for gymnastics yet, and can we please eat today? And you know what, all that shit takes money, so I'd like some. Something something, links.vicerhino.com, and if you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time!